Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. As the great unlock happens and everybody has another argument about masks, we thought we'd focus on the positive and ask, what good has the pandemic ever done for us? I'm going to be joined by Ben Spencer, Sunday Times science editor, to talk through some of the unexpected upsides of the past 18 months. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, it's our columnist panel. It's Monday, so it must be Libby Rachey. It's Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. So, we know there's bad stuff going on, but sometimes it's nice to focus on the positive, which is what we're going to do this morning. And our big thing at 11, we're going to look at some of the positive things, particularly around science and medicine, which have emerged over the past 18 months, with Ben Spencer, the science editor of the Sunday Times. So I'd ask you for your positives from the last year. Jonathan emails in, as I was back home during the pandemic, I thought I'd try and teach an old dog new tricks and teach my 69-year-old mum to play saxophone. She's doing grade one now, thanks COVID. Jonathan, send us a video. We want to see your mum playing the saxophone. I'd also like to see a video of your mum, her reaction to you describing her as an old dog. Best of luck with that. Someone on the text says, I discovered a lot of places I can go to can actually be reached more quickly on foot than on the bus. Also, we have lots of green spaces around us. Who knew? Fenton says, I've written a cookery book after cooking a gourmet meal 7 days a week. Becky says, one positive of the last year is that parents' evenings are now on Zoom. No more leaving work early, teenage daughter sighing over what I'm wearing. No more hanging around the sports hall, sighing while the parents in front ask just one more thing. Now, parents' evening is done and dusted in 40 minutes. Even better, last week we were due to have a virtual parents' evening and we got a note from the teacher saying, if you want to cancel, that's fine, because he's very busy. So we did. So we didn't even have to log on to Zoom. And Morven says, good to finally meet neighbours and scotch my preconceptions about them. That axe-wielding loner is a witty, friendly jazz musician. That alcoholic floozy has a neurological condition, but also a keen fashion sense. And why not? We were in bubbles long before COVID, and now not so much. There we are. Keep those coming in. 8722, starting match of the word Times. Tweet me, at Times Radio. You can email studio@times.radio, particularly if you want to send videos of family members playing the saxophone. Good excuse just to play that song. Right, it's that time of the morning. We always speak to two of our favourite columnists, and it's Monday, so it must be Libby Rachey. Good morning, Libby Purvis.
Morning.
And good morning, Rachel Sylvester.
Hi, Matt.
So, have you all been out? Have you both been out clubbing overnight? Are you?
Of course. Can't you imagine it?
Have you? Do you know what? I could actually, all too easily. I think a Times columnist's trip to a nightclub
club night
is definitely in order. So I want to discuss, there's a really interesting polling in the Times today from YouGov. 31% of people will be happy to go to a party in the next 3 weeks, compared with 53% who said they wouldn't. 34% would go to the theatre, 48% wouldn't. 20% of people aged 18 to 24 said they'd be happy to go to a nightclub, but 53% wouldn't. And I just wondered where you were both on this. Are you rushing out to take advantage of your newfound freedoms, Libby?
I have been to the Ironmonger without wearing a mask. It was massively exciting. Yes. But, you know, listen, I have. This is really not new. For weeks and weeks, it's been absolutely clear in the polling that half the country is horrified at the idea of unlocking. And it seems to me that what the government is doing is quite clever. They know that the people who are being careful and obeying will go on doing so, and that those who don't care and didn't do anything anyway will go on as they were and go off super spreading and per government approved Wimbledon, Silverstone. But by removing the legal bars, when it all goes belly up come September or October, they can blame us. They can sort of say, we gave you freedom and you abused it. So I think it's a political move in a way. You know, they know perfectly well that there will be immense amount of care still taken. A lot of people are still very, very nervous. And that nervousness will make them careful and circumspect. So I'm not at all surprised by this polling.
I suppose the thing is that we all do now know. I'm sure there might be some people who haven't quite cottoned on about this pandemic business, but we do now know the basics. You know, if you're in a small enclosed space with not much ventilation, that's less good than being outside. So if you are indoors and you know, you put your mask on and all that, people sort of know all of that. Just on your point about the government trying to shift the blame, asked if the relaxation of coronavirus rules leads to a large increase in cases and hospitalisations, who, if anyone, would be mainly responsible? 42% say the government. 42% say individuals. It would be the public's fault. So it's completely split down the middle, Rachel.
That's really fascinating. And I think Boris Johnson would see that as a good poll rating, actually, if he's only got, you know, if it's equally divided between people blaming him and people blaming themselves, effectively. That's quite good for the government. But there is, it's almost like being in hibernation, isn't it? People have been locked up and they're emerging, blinking into the sunlight. And it is a bit nerve-wracking. So I went to the butcher this morning and I wore my mask rather pathetically, unlike Libby at the Ironmonger. You just not, I think there's going to be a lot more ambiguity. And also there's a sort of sense of etiquette about what's polite to other people rather than just what's safe. So I sort of felt it was polite to wear it still. Even though obviously legally you weren't obliged to. But I think more than that, there's a sort of sense of, I think people are going to feel, and I do actually, you feel nervous of crowds. I feel nervous if I'm on a crowded tube. The idea of going to a sort of nightclub would always fill me with horror, but even more so the idea of being in a crowded place of any sort is really nerve-wracking. I saw those pictures at Wembley and I felt sort of frightened by that, the proximity. So that is sort of strange change. We're in this kind of hibernation mode still. I mean, I think it's going to take a while to get back to normal.
Libby, you've been back at various points when they've been able to. You've been to theatres when there's been social distancing.
Absolutely.
And so on. What about the idea of going into a theatre where every seat was taken? Is that something you're looking forward to?
It absolutely is something I'm looking forward to, because without it, the theatres will collapse. I wouldn't mind going on wearing a mask if it makes everybody else feel comfortable. That's fine. I can sit through any length of theatre in a mask. But no, I'm absolutely looking forward to being in theatres again. Theatres are very well run. They're very well organised. I mean, there was a very funny thing the other day online. Somebody sort of said, you know, why are pubs able to open, you know, and not theatres? You know, is it the case that sometimes in a theatre or concert hall, someone just listens to one note too many and is sick on the floor, you know, or gets into a fight? You know, of course, this never happens. You know, the point is, theatres are quite sort of regimented and people are looking and facing forward and the ventilation is good. So I think that I have no sort of fear at all of it. I wouldn't go to Wembley because I wouldn't go to Wembley, but I would go in any other kind of crowd that I was interested in being in. I probably wouldn't hang around sort of shouting in people's faces in the foyer, but actually I never do. I always sneak down to my seat early and read the programme. So, no, I don't have the slightest problem with theatres.
I suppose that's the point, isn't it? Actually, we know that the real risk is people socialising in each other's houses, getting up close and personal, you know, away from organised events. You know, if you've been going into restaurants and bars or whatever, you know, the space in which, I know some of that will change. But, you know, there are, you're sort of very much aware of the COVID restrictions and organisation around you in a way that you're just not if you're going to somebody's house.
Definitely. And there's a sense that also I think we've got more used to being outside and understanding. But Libby's column this morning about the importance of ventilation, you have this sense of the sort of fresh air being a good thing in a way we didn't before. I think that's great. And Libby's right. You know, open the windows. That's a good thing.
And ditch the hand sanitizers, the other big message from your column, Libby.
It's just there's been this huge emphasis on hand sanitizing and surfaces and so on, and there's been far too little talk about ventilation. And it struck me that, you know, my gosh, you know, houses are so sealed up and people are so obsessed with not having heat loss, you know, and emissions, you know, not enough heat being lost out of public buildings and so on. And I think ventilation was pretty bad in a lot of places. And so I went into all, I spent a whole weekend on all these learned papers and research papers and government surveys, and it turned out, yes, I'm bang right. Everybody who thinks about these things has been worried about this for years. You know, 10 years ago, this EU paper saying that actually this business of sealing buildings up is not necessarily going to be conducive to public health. And so I thought I'd haul out some of this stuff and maybe direct other people towards it. It matters.
You know, it's really interesting. And actually, I've been sort of collecting examples of things that you couldn't touch because of COVID, even though, the idea that you were all catching COVID off of touching people. My favourite, I think, so far has been the flagpoles when we went to a pitch and putt. We were banned from touching the flagpoles. You know, we're outside. It's only us there. And we weren't allowed, on pain of death, we were not to touch the flagpoles because of COVID. And then the balls were sort of thrown into a furnace or a bucket of bleach or something afterwards. Mm. Nobody's really been having that conversation about ventilation.
And yet buses and trains no longer have opening windows. You know, a lot of houses don't. You may stay the night at a budget premier inn or something. You may well find the windows simply don't open and that the air is processed for you. Well, you don't know how good the filtration is. You don't know how often the filters are checked. These things really matter. The air conditioning is okay as long as it's absolutely top quality and very expensively run and maintained. You know, but quite often it simply is not, and windows don't open.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good point about the trains. The good old days of, you know, pulling down the train door window and just getting some air in on a hot day, that made a massive difference. Kate's just texted in saying, Florence Nightingale knew about fresh air, nothing new here. That's literally the headline almost on Libby's column. Just in terms of the politics of where we are, this feels like a moment of peril for the government, Rachel. Just because, you know, there's what, 50-odd percent of people say that this is the wrong thing to be doing to opening up now. There was a massive wobble yesterday over the Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak taking advantage of the pilot scheme that we meant they could get out of self-isolation. They suddenly sort of stepped back from that. But this could be a really difficult summer politically for the government, couldn't it?
Definitely. I think the most toxic thing for them is that sense that it's one rule for them and another rule for the rest of us. So the Dominic Cummings trip to Barnard Castle, the reason that was such a disaster is because it gave the impression that the rich and powerful, or not rich necessarily, but the powerful and close to Boris Johnson don't have to follow the rules in the way that everyone else does. And that was why it's unbelievable, really, that Downing Street and the Treasury thought it was a good idea for Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak to be miraculously chosen for this extraordinary exemption scheme. And then it's no surprise they very quickly U-turned on it. But that's very dangerous.
At the same time... Yeah, but Rachel, I am staring at the moment at a graph which has the Tories still well above the other parties in polling. How is this happening?
In the latest YouGov poll, Tories are on 44%, up 2. Labour up 1 on 31, Lib Dems on 8. So 44, so what's that? Tories have got a 13-point lead.
Yeah, I think
somebody I was talking to yesterday said that the extraordinary thing is that he's more annoyed by Keir Starmer on television than he is by Boris. And he's shouting, how is this happening? How is this happening? Why is Keir Starmer more annoying than Boris?
Well, they've still got the vaccine bounds for sure, haven't they? They're still. And I think also people see the pandemic as something beyond the control of governments of any political persuasion. But where it will go wrong is if it looks like they've rushed to open too quickly, or when it's sort of one rule for them, one rule for the rest of us. But so far, you're absolutely right. It's not having any dire impact, which is pretty extraordinary.
I think the thing to sort of remember sometimes is that the public voters, people who apply to polls, are contradictory, complicated people. It is possible to think, I really want things to go back to normal. I hate all of this, and you know, Boris Johnson is offering us apparently a route back to that, while also being quite worried about what's going on, and you're worried about your gran and all of that. And we are all, you know, we basically want everyone else to abide by some rules so that the pandemic goes away, while we can get back to enjoying ourselves in the way that we were. Just on the subject of Keir Starmer, in the latest YouGov poll on the question of who would make the best Prime Minister, 37% say Boris Johnson, 27% say Keir Starmer, behind not sure on 31%. Keir Starmer currently trailing. I don't know. He probably hopes for a summer where he can turn that around a bit as well. Libby Post and Rachel Sylvester there, and of course you can read them both in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription, go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, what did the pandemic ever do for us?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now, let's focus on the positive. All of this was slightly borne out of a really fascinating piece by the Sunday Times science editor, Ben Spencer, a week or so ago about some of the big, I'll be honest, slightly complicated science breakthroughs of the past 18 months, which will actually be have a positive effect for probably years to come. And Ben joins us now. Hi, Ben.
Good morning.
Now, you're going to have to hold my hand and walk me very, which we can now do, of course, because that's not illegal, at least in England, and walk me through some of these big breakthroughs that you focused on. Because I'll be honest, whether it was liquid biopsies or the, what was the other one that really, there was liquid biopsies. And nanotech heroic. Talk me through some of these big scientific breakthroughs and why they are a positive, not just in sort of terms of dealing with the pandemic, but why they might have a positive benefit for longer.
Well, I won't be able to hold your hand quite yet because I'm marking Freedom Day by spending the time in self-isolation with my two young sons and wife. Because I got a bit of a cough last week and went to get my test result on Friday. Results still not come through, so I am marking Freedom Day in self-isolation.
Indeed.
But this, I mean, is kind of, I mean, it's an absolute pain, but it's actually one of the big scientific successes of the pandemic, that we now have this absolutely immense diagnostics program. I could go to a walkthrough on a Friday, have a swab, send it off, and hopefully in a few hours I'll get a result. You know, this is a massive diagnostics program that just wasn't in place a year ago. I don't know if you remember thinking back to last March and April, Matt Hancock desperately trying to get up to 100,000 tests a day. We're now doing 1 million tests a day, some days even more. It's absolutely incredible the diagnostics rollout that has taken place over the last year, created an industry from scratch. Now,
and is there a read across that in future we could have a similar scaled testing program for other things which aren't COVID?
I mean, that's the hope. I mean, much of our medicine at the moment is basically educated guesswork. I mean, for example, you don't have a test for flu. You just, these tests exist, but no one really has them. They only take place in really, really serious cases. But most people, if you're assumed you've got flu, you spend a few days in bed, and people don't generally think they just have a guess, right? But in the future, there's a hope that now that we've rolled out and created this diagnostics, this testing industry from scratch, we could start testing for things. We could have more of a personalised medicine. Similarly, for things like cancer, the tests are actually quite crude. And we've built this genomics infrastructure from scratch. A year ago, we basically didn't have any way of testing the DNA of COVID samples. We were only testing a small proportion of tests that were coming through, see what the DNA was like. At the moment, we're testing about 70% of samples for the full DNA, the full genomic analysis of every COVID sample. Now, that means we can spot variants. And the idea is that with cancer, you'll start to use that infrastructure. And I think you've got Angela George coming on.
Yeah, she's
shortly
coming up. She's going to talk about one of the big breakthroughs on that front. Yeah.
So the idea is soon you'll be able to really assess the DNA of every cancer patient and really develop a finely tuned, personalised treatment plan rather than your catch-all chemotherapy, radiotherapy. You'd actually be able to genetically identify. And these are all things that have been in the works for years, but we've shown over the last year that we can roll these out rapidly at scale. And it's actually, you know, it's doable.
There's also, we should also obviously talk about vaccines and the number of times we've been told normally this would have taken years and years. And, you know, there are other things, whether it's AIDS or, you know, other illnesses, which they still have not yet developed a vaccine for. But it turns out if it affects the entire world and everyone throws the kitchen sink at it, it could be done much, much more quickly. Could we therefore see other vaccines emerge for other illnesses, which up until now haven't been developed?
Definitely. So there's two broad technologies which have emerged so far for the vaccine. One is the Oxford vaccine. That uses something called a viral vector. You take a chimpanzee virus, you insert a bit of DNA code for the COVID, and you inject it into someone. Now, that bit of DNA code could be for any other illness. And they've already started trials for using the same platform of the Oxford virus for malaria and also for HIV. Now, think about it. All these years, we've had no vaccines for HIV and for malaria. Now, the other type of vaccine, one that's used for the Pfizer vaccine, for the Moderna vaccine, is mRNA. Now, that's another bit of genetic code that's basically wrapped up into this little fatty bubble called a nanoparticle and injected. And likewise, you can change the code. So the team behind the mRNA, the teams behind the mRNA vaccines are already testing it for flu, for pandemic flu, making a much, much better flu vaccine, and for things like HIV as well. And the idea is that eventually both these teams are working on vaccinating against cancer. Now, I must emphasize, both these technologies have been in works for years. mRNA has been about two decades in the process. So it's largely a bit of very, very fortunate timing that when the pandemic struck, both these technologies were close to fruition. But if the pandemic hadn't come along when it had, it would have probably been a long, long time before we got to the point where we were able to be confident enough to start trialing them for other treatments, other conditions. But we've had the world's biggest rollout of any medical intervention, really, in the vaccine trials and the vaccine programs globally. And we've now got this huge amount of data about the positives, the negatives, the side effects, what works, what doesn't work. So that's really going to accelerate vaccines of all kinds.
It's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. Ben Spencer, thanks so much for joining us and talking us through all of those positives. Ben Spencer, the Sunday Times science editor. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcast from.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.